I suppose the title of my last talk here would be Hope for Europe, ? Because certainly when many commentators look at the idea of hope for Europe, they don't see much hope. The good news, however, and one of the most encouraging things you can do is to look at past moments in history when similarly people have felt very little hope. And I would just like to give you one of those illustrations, which I'm very fond of, which is from the year 1640, which is from probably the worst year in European history before 1940. It was the height of the 30 Years' War. Protestants were killing Catholics. Catholics were killing Protestants, Christians were killing Jews, everyone was killing people who they believed to be witches. And so savage was the violence, often in the name of religion, that people often argued whether European civilization would survive or deserved to survive. And in that year, a great saint, one of the greatest saints of the age, Saint Vincent de Paul, made a remark which I commend to your attention. And he said in 1640, Jesus said, his church would last till the end of time. He never mentioned the word Europe. The church of the future, he said in 1640, would be the church of South America, of Africa, of China, and Japan. And I suggest to you that that is a prophetic remark. It's an empirically verifiable prophecy. But was he wrong about Europe? And, you know, at least in the short term, he was. And it's a very typical situation where you have these very grim prognoses for the future of Europe, which are then followed by real eras of flourishing. For example, if you think of your history, 1640, terrible, terrible time. Think what was happening by the 1670s and 1680s. Just think of whatever tradition you're from. In the 1670s and 1680s, this is the age in England of the Pilgrim's Progress, a great writing of John Bunyan. In Germany, it's the era of the Pietists, of the book Pia Desideria by P.J. Spener. It's the roots of what would become an evangelical awakening. It's one of the greatest ages of Christian music, architecture. So, you know, yes, Jesus' church was indeed continuing in Europe. So when we hear today very grim remarks, very grim warnings about the lack of hope for Europe, how can we assess them? How bad are things? And what I'd like to do is suggest some of possibly the worst areas, the worst pieces of news, and then look at some of the signs of hope that I'm aware of. And I suppose the grim signs are not hard to see. They're things that, you know, that must have registered with you. Europe has passed through one of the greatest ages of secularization, not just in its history, but in the history of any society. You look, for instance, at the year 1960 or 1965 as a starting point. You look at the great age of, you know, activity of Christian writing, of Christian faith, however you measure it, in the 1950s. And then you look at a very steep decline. You know, if you look, for example, at the Roman Catholic Church, I often use what I call the rule of 10, which is if you want to compare things today with what they were in 1960, just divide by 10. Look at the number of vocations, look at the number of people in seminaries, look at the, you know, available number of priests, or sworn religious, and so on, and, you know, things are obviously very, very difficult indeed. There is a widespread secularization which has had a particular impact on two critical areas. One is politics, obviously. When I talked the other night, I mentioned the idea of the failure to mention God or religion in the European Constitution. The other is law. And I cannot stress this enough. If you want to trace attitudes to religion, pay very, very serious attention to what is happening in European courts, in European debates over over human rights. You know, we've had the famous controversy in the last couple of years over whether a crucifix can be displayed on the walls of schools in Italy. The first decision was no, the second decision was yes. Please note, cases like this will be back. And also, European courts have demonstrated very clearly that where religious rights run into conflict with rights based on gender, sexual orientation, that religious rights will take a second or a third place. And that's especially true in some countries, notably Great Britain, where some of the recent legal decisions have actually been terrifying. Where, for example, we had a wonderful statement not long ago that religion is entirely a private matter. Religion is entirely a question of private opinion, as it can never be subject to proof or rational argument. So much for 2,000 years of apologetics and philosophy. In one way, this is extremely bad news, because law shapes the environment for public discussion. On another side, it could even be an encouraging sign for this reason. The more European courts exercise a kind of federal jurisdiction reminiscent of what US courts have done for many years, the more they force people to decide where they stand on issues of religion, public expression, religious freedom, and they perhaps make people who have no particular commitment to religion, religious affiliation, they make those people ask themselves, am I prepared to live in a wholly secular society? And in some countries, this will fit with the traditions of the country. France is very used to laïcité. In other countries, that's a different option, especially those that traditionally have established forms of religion. So I would suggest that the next 10 years or so, if you have the slightest interest in law as an issue, law and politics, are going to be a fascinating time. And even if you don't, start paying close attention to these court decisions, because they shape the potential for churches to grow and express themselves publicly, especially on controversial moral issues. Because let me say this very simply. According to the recent standards of many courts, religion is an absolutely fine thing, as long as it is entirely private and nobody speaks out on any issue which could conceivably cause offense. And that sort of religion is a very, very bad thing. Just a suggestion. I would also draw your attention to one issue which has been a huge thing over many European countries in the last year or two, which is the sexual abuse crisis in the Roman Catholic Church. And your attitude may be this is something that affects the Roman Catholic Church, it doesn't affect other churches. Please note that rhetorically, in terms of public attitudes, that crisis is going to have a huge impact on Christianity generally and religion generally, because for many people who would define themselves as non-religious, non-affiliated, that will be exhibit A in the case against what would be seen as religious hypocrisy, and particularly the suppression of natural sexuality by a Christian tradition. Pay attention to that. So if I look for warning signs in Europe, as I said, the pace of secularization has been, I don't know, I rather run out of words at this point. By the time you've said catastrophic and dramatic and all these other words, shall we say, really serious. and extraordinarily fast. Are there signs of hope? Clearly, I believe there are, and I've written to that effect. Some of the what I would see as signs of hope involve the reaction to public debates. I've been very interested in the last decade or so at the reaction to some of the controversies about Islam, and particularly violence related to Islam. It was very interesting, for example, when you had the Danish cartoons about Muhammad, and you had all these demonstrations around Europe. And it was very interesting hearing people in Denmark being quoted as saying things like, huh, what will happen next? They'll be stopping us going to church next. Not that the urge to go to church had ever been terribly strong in Denmark, but people were acting as if they were being forced to decide what kind of society they wanted to live in and whether they wanted to live in a society where some religions were allowed to express themselves, but others were not. And I think for many people, including a number of intellectuals and writers, this led them to re-explore the roots of Europe. You may have noticed some of the writings of the great thinker Habermas in terms of looking at what are the roots of the human rights that Europe takes for granted. European countries are great advocates of human rights, defenders of human rights. Where do those rights come from? For many scholars, unless those rights are rooted in some kind of notion of God or nature's God or the God of Christianity, what right do they have to exist apart from opinion? And as I said, I was interested in that. I also see a couple of significant signs of growth which would have been astonishing 20 years ago, 30 years ago. For me, personally, my opinion, by far the most important, impressive, represent immigrant churches across Europe, a phenomenon that was very little studied just a few years ago, but now, of course, is absolutely impossible to ignore. You all know about these experiences yourself, and I could give any number of anecdotes. But I was interested, for example, a couple of years ago, I was in Aarhus in Denmark, where people were gathered in huge numbers outside a small church. And I think this is very counterintuitive for my sense of Denmark, and doubly so because it was a Roman Catholic church, which again is counterintuitive in Denmark. And then he realized what the Catholic Church there was from the signs on the door. It gave mass times in the languages of English, Polish, Vietnamese, Tamil, and Chaldean for Iraqi Christians. That's a surprising sense of the constituency in a country. On any typical Sunday in England, in London, half the worshippers at Christian churches will be black. They will be African or Afro-Caribbean. The four largest mega churches in Great Britain are all pastored by Africans. There are very large mega churches run by Africans in France, in Belgium. And you also have true examples of globalization, of churches established by Africans in Europe that have then developed very successful missions back to Africa. And whenever I wish to amaze Americans and puzzle them with some of their assumptions about Europe, I always refer, of course, to the great church in Kiev in the Ukraine, pastored by Sunday Adeleja, which is, of course, a Nigerian-run church in the Ukraine, which teaches us one of the great lessons in political economy of our time. You probably know the story of Sunday Adeleja came to the Ukraine during the Soviet times when they were trying to recruit the best and the brightest from around the Third World to become Marxist-Leninists and go back and create revolution in those countries. Then the Soviet Union ceased to exist. Sunday Adeleja set up his church, and it grew and it grew until it has around about 50,000 members, which raised the issue, or would raise the issue for many people, of where you put 50,000 people. This, however, is not a problem because in the Soviet Union, they were very good at building great sports complexes, large halls for party gatherings, trade union gatherings, and this therefore resolves the question of what was the historical role of communism. It was to build churches large enough for Pentecostal congregations. In a sense, there's a great justice in this sense of, did you ever see the film The Empire Strikes Back? Well, the empires are striking back. It was, in fact, Christianity that established, I suppose, globalization. You know, globalization is a word that we hear a great deal in the news, in the headlines. I can date the beginnings of globalization very precisely. It's not 1970, it's not 1914. It is 1578 when the Roman Catholic Church establishes a diocese at Manila in the Philippines as an offshoot of the Archbishopric of Mexico City. And that is the first empire in history to be a global empire. And the Roman Catholic Church is the first organization in history to operate on a global scale. All the other empires of history, Roman, Parthian, Mongol, were piffling little Eurasian organizations. This was a global empire, 1578. It's only natural, then, that the Catholic Church, that Christian churches should be, as the pioneers of globalization, the beneficiaries of globalization. You know, I recommend that you turn to one page on the web, which is, if you ever read Wikipedia, it's normally a site of great treasures and great blunders. I think it cites me as Henry Jenkins more than once. But there's one article I really like, which is called The World's Fastest Growing Religion. And this is about 20 religions, including Islam, Buddhism, Scientology, many, many other religions, and the point being that you cannot trust any of the claims that religions make. But realistically, I can tell you what is the greatest, the world's fastest growing religion, and it's very simple. It's three words: Christianity outside Europe. If you take Europe out of the picture, then there's absolutely no doubt the fastest growing religion in history is Christianity. Now, Europe, unfortunately, serves as something of an anchor in the story. But at least it benefits from the story. And you think of all these, you know, case studies, you look at churches in London, Roman Catholic churches, which are down to 50 in their congregation, and just as a desperate measure, they begin a Portuguese mass, and the following week they've got 1,500 worshippers. In other words, the European churches survive and flourish from that immigrant strength. And to use a phrase that we've heard more than once in the last day or two, what should the cry of European churches be to these outsiders? Come on over and help us. So what I would suggest is this, that European churches find themselves in a, I would say, as uniquely different, difficult an environment that they could find themselves short of active persecution. I plead guilty to using the phrase in my God's Continent that in terms of sustaining organized religion, Europe represents a malarial swamp. It is a very difficult environment. But against that background, churches grow, churches succeed, and churches innovate. I look with awe at some of the flexibility of old established churches that have developed new and very active, charismatic branches within the Church of England, for example, the Alpha Course, a triumphant example of innovation that takes account of new realities in social, economic structure, family structure. I look at some of the charismatic bodies, often drawing on Pentecostal inspiration, within the Roman Catholic Church. I like the remark of the Roman Catholic Cardinal, who said, after the Pentecostal movement, the Alpha Course is the greatest gift of Protestantism to the Catholic Church. Those are the two greatest gifts to the Catholic Church. And I think that represents the beginning of potentially of an alliance in a new Europe. And of course, there's a whole Orthodox dimension to this. And I look again with awe at the way in which so many of the churches and monasteries, those great centers of the spirit, have been restored in East European countries, including Bulgaria, including Russia, and the Ukraine, since that miraculous fall of communism. So I suppose I would end with two things. One is to say, so what should European Christians do? The first thing they should do is conduct a very careful inventory of what they have, which sets them apart. Europe is very distinctive in its... above all, in its wealth, in its technology, in so many things which can be seen as problems of materialism, but which also offer enormous advantages around the world. I began with Vincent de Paul in 1640, and I can give you other examples, but I will end with prophecies of doom from the 1790s. In the 1790s, if you were a rational person, you knew that Christianity was doomed. You knew that when, for example, the Pope was taken into captivity by the forces of revolutionary France, when priests in their hundreds and their thousands were being executed, when monasteries were being forcibly secularized across Europe, you knew that the days of Christianity were doomed, and that was the time that in the United States great man and often very wise man and often very stupid man, Thomas Jefferson, said that within 100 years, he said, the great religion of the United States and of much of the world will be Unitarianism. Well, no. Come back 20 years after the 1790s, what was flourishing again? Evangelical awakening. Catholic awakening, a great age of Christian writing, and if you like, a Christian renaissance. So what's the best argument? I can tell you that Europe has hope, that everyone's convinced it doesn't. And on that, I will leave you. Thank you.